still on course two and sub course C. And I was just interested around the section 32 of the evaluation with regards to that wording, in terms of identifying other reasonably practical options for achieving the objective and assessing the efficiency and effectiveness of the provisions in achieving the objective. So what analysis has been undertaken of these provisions to show they are a more appropriate way of achieving the PCM objective?
Well, the only text 32 that's been done today is obviously consideration of the evidence that's been put forward, which hasn't been formalised into an evaluation at this point.
So, no evaluation?
There's been consideration of the evidence that's been put forward, of which there's been quite some body evidence.
Sorry?
Of which there's been quite a body evidence.
Right.
In terms of the
but in answer to my question, what evaluation? Or analysis, no, that hasn't been carried out, has it?
No.
And just looking at clause 5 for a moment, just in terms of clause 5, it talks about the water bodies from which cattle, horses, deer, and pigs must be excluded, and then it also uses the same wording, although in relation to slopes, as proposed for clause 2 in terms of that process that we step through. Would you agree with that? Does that make sense? So in clause 5, clause C, it provides for unless an environment plan for the property has been prepared, and the resource management vegetable plans and the supervisor appointed. So that's the same wording as used in clause 2C. You agree? In terms of just that part of it, yes. And so how is the certification of FEP under the RMA requirements in terms of how that's assessed versus the assessment of FEPs under PC1. Are you able to talk to that at all? Please ask if you can
answer. Yeah, no, I'm just trying to make sure I understand the question.
Yeah.
The wrong answer.
So there's a process under the freshwater regs, referred to, for certifying plans,
yes.
And then there's also proposed in PC1 a process for that same.
Oh, sorry.
Yep.
So the process is the same. The process is the process set out in the legislation, the regulation. And the way I see it working is you have to meet the requirements of the government regulation as well as the matters set out in the schedule D1 and D2. So,
I'm trying to understand your understanding.
Yeah. So there's a process set out which certifying has to look at certain aspects of the environment plan and certify that they're meeting the requirements. So I see that as the same that has to be done. It's just different in regard to PC1, there will be some specific matters that we have to look at in addition to what these regulations say.
So is it your evidence that when it comes to a certifier under the RMA, the regional plan provisions apply there as well?
I'd have to look at the regulations. My understanding is that yes, you can take, you may have regard to the matters required by the regional plan and certify the requirements.
Are you familiar with section 217 of the RMA?
So you looked at it a few times.
Yeah.
I'm not quite.
Sorry, I don't know if you've got a copy there, I'll just step you through it.
So,
and look, I'm just seeking your understanding, so bear with me. So under 217F of the RMA, it sets out the content of freshwater farm plans, and then the freshwater farm plan must identify any adverse effects of the activities carried out on the farm, on freshwater and freshwater ecosystems, and specified requirements that are appropriate for the purpose of avoiding, remedying or mitigating adverse effects on those freshwater and any freshwater ecosystems and are clear and measurable, demonstrate how any outcomes prescribed in the regulations are to be achieved and comply with any other requirements in the regulations, and then comply with section 217L. You go there, then it talks about what's to be complied with, and it refers to specified instruments. And so if you go and look at what that means, I just want to understand if you think specified instruments includes regional plans. And so when you look at the interpretation of specified instruments, it talks about designations, national environment, standards, national planning standards, regulations, resource consents, and then a rule in a plan, and then a conservation order. So I guess, is the Schedule C part of the rules? You see that as part of the rules. Okay. Thank you. And so do you see any risk on certifying plans or under the RMA versus under the PC1 process? Can you see any?
A few risks on.
Yeah, so there's different processes under the regulation versus the PC1 provisions. Do you see any issues or concerns from your perspective as a planner?
I see the process as being that's set out the legislation and the regulations. And the things that will need to be considered will include those things you read out, plus the matters specified in these schedules. That's how I would see it operating. So I don't see any problems with operates like that.
Thank you. And so in terms of 5E of the provisions provided yesterday, again, if we go back, water bodies from which cattle, horses, deer and pigs must be excluded is any wetland, including a constructed wetland, greater than 500 square metres. And so you've been in court, I know, last week and this week, yes, so you would have heard the evidence, particularly from Dr. Robinson, around how small wetlands are more vulnerable to the effects of contaminants, and that was agreed to in the joint witness statement for wetlands. Do you accept
yes,
that?
Yes.
And so in terms of coming up with that wording, what consideration was given to the technical evidence provided by the Director General?
Well, this isn't the same boat as the setbacks, and it isn't a matter of decreased evidence or people to consider that came out as part of this proposal that Dr. Barnes mentioned put together yesterday. So it's not a matter that I have dwelt on. However, I certainly would say that I think 50 square metres is an unreasonably small and practical area of fence as a matter of course. And you know, I think we have evidence on one of the very first days, simply about tens of thousands of these potentially existing, which was news to me, it just, from a practical point of view, as much as we'd like to see the wetland fence, it didn't seem a realistic thing to have to do, particularly with a buffer around it and all the issues that you have there. So although I didn't give this, this isn't a matter I've given a lot of consideration to, because it hasn't been in my brief, but I do consider it 50 years existing.
Do you know if any of the other planners who support this version, have they given much thought to it? Just so I know who I asked it.
I think the other planner that would be easy to ask would be the Lands planner.
Who's the one?
Ms. Foster.
Okay, thank you for that. And just interested, whilst the Director General doesn't have a view around the slope, I was just interested in your view around the justification using 10 degrees over 15 degrees.
Yeah, and this is something I have given a lot to you, Mark, please know. And it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, the slope degree, and we've been involved in slope screening for a long time, tends to be used as a way of trying to match the requirements for if it is reasonable and practical for people to do. probably not much more sophisticated than that. So there's an arbitrary, it's somewhat arbitrary, and we're just trying to kind of recognise the risks and practicality, but also just trying to match what's required. So the 15 degrees, and I did do some looking at this the other day because I was trying to work out where it came from, and I understand it came from the draft regulations that appeared back in 1997 by the previous government. It ended up in draft form, it never went anywhere. And it was what was latched onto, I suppose, as the threshold by the... Because at the time of the hearing, the panel hearing, it was thought that, I guess it was assumed that those regulations would come into force, and they did come into force. And then they were reviewed, of course, by the new government on the central threshold program, and a different threshold was eventually chosen. So I guess what I'm saying is there isn't a magic to those numbers. It's about finding one that we think captures the maximum amount that is possible for being practical. And I was somewhat influenced, by the evidence that suggested that I think 86% of dairy land and something close to 69% of dry stock land would be captured, which overall I suppose is somewhat like a massive growth. But looking at about 50% each of the probably pastoral area, you're looking at something between 87 and 69, so probably 79% of the catchment being covered by that 10% slope threshold, which seemed to me to be the lion's share and a reasonably ambitious goal for that geographic survey. If we could get that, universal spot, we would have that much of a catchment, I think would make an enormous difference.
Thank you. And so my last lot of questions is just around the exclusions at the end of the new wording. So on the second page,
yes.
Where it talks about, for the purpose of Chapter 311, the requirement of sheepish seed use. So the second page of the wording, and at the end, the very last paragraph in red, says, for the purpose of Chapter 311, requirements in Schedule C do not apply to ephemeral springs or ephemeral water bodies. And then it goes on to define the ephemeral water bodies. And so, you've no doubt listened to the evidence from Ms. Keswick Ms. MacArthur, around critical source areas and how ephemeral water bodies is where critical source areas generally are. And so, how does that work alongside critical source areas? Have you got any view there?
Well, the extent to which an ephemeral water body might be a critical source area, and it might, they would be managed under Schedule D1, D2, as the D1, I guess, for dry stock farms. So if you were doing something that is high risk on the farm, grazing, but we're doing some cropping or grape feeding or something of that nature, then I would expect those ephemeral water bodies would be treated as a critical source area and could be managed. And I think that's what Dr. Capri was saying this morning, which is very clear way, that it's activity driven, so the extent to which there is activity which is high risk, the ones I mentioned are pretty high risk, rather than grazing, then there would be some exclusion, use of different techniques to try and mitigate the risks in those areas.
So it's something that really hasn't been given much thought to as well, do you think?
No, I think it's been given thought to. If you look at the Schedule D1, there are several references to critical source areas in there. And so I would see that those risks will be managed as best as can through the farm environment plan, specifying actions that are required when certain activities are undertaken in these critical source areas and for the water bodies.
And just in terms of that definition, it excludes ephemeral water bodies, it's one of the descriptions there is that it's not a wetland. And so if we go back up to 5E, where it excludes wetlands 500 square metres, so 50 that was there, and it's not included in the definition of ephemeral. And if it has the same, in here it talks about has a bed that is predominantly vegetated, and given the high rainfall, that could be adapted to wet areas, wet conditions as well, that could potentially constitute the definition of wetland. Are you following my thinking here? And so I guess what I'm trying to raise here is how are these wetlands to be managed if they're excluded from the water bodies from which cattle, horses and deer have access to, and it's not covered in the definition of ephemeral. Do you think there's a bit of a lacuna or a gap for wetlands under 50 metres square? There's nothing there to capture those?
Under 50 metres?
Yeah. Or 50 or less?
I can't say I haven't actually addressed that particular question. I would need to go through the plan and see what things might apply or what aspects of this farm plan schedules might apply. I think there is a general. The other thing is, of course, the certification of a farm plan. Sorry, the farm plan thing of the farm plan regulations does require risk assessment more broadly than what might be required under Schedule D1, for example. So to the extent to which a risk assessment, perhaps in fact that some of those wetlands might be important and might be at risk, then the farm plan would need to specify some actions to address those risks. So there is an element of discretion as to the extent to which that's done and how that's done. But I wouldn't say that they are left entirely in a lacuna. There is definitely an opportunity to the farm planning process as set out in the regulations for some of those issues to be identified and managed on the farm if people think that's appropriate, necessary, and practical.
And that's all left to the discretion of the certifier.
That is how it works.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Now, my questions aren't going to relate to your evidence at all. Hopefully, other than your.
Will they relate to relevant?
Hopefully, just not as evidence. So. Stop me if they're not.
Well.
PC1 at least, yes. And relating to the version of Plan Change 1 that your client has now put before the court. Now, you have been quite careful in answers to Ms. Toomai this morning to make it clear what was within your brief and what was beyond. But my questions relate solely to the drafting gates, which I understand to be squarely within your brief. Is that correct?
Yes.
So I'd like to start with the decisions version of the drafting gates, which, as I'm sure you'll recall, have a gateway for dry stock and a gateway for all other farming. Is that your recollection? And so it wasn't dry stock and dairy, but dry stock and all other farming.
I'd just like to read the
decision's version is
it's in the yellow back version folder under tab 1.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, you're quite right.
101-0121 is the document number. It was just that in each of those rules, there was a dry stock drafting gate and then a all other farming drafting gate. Right. And so if we just briefly start with dry stock, and if you could turn to the definition of seeds. Yes, for the version that we have, either is fine. May have heard me attempt to ask Mr. Trevalco some questions in relation to the dry stock definition last week, but generally speaking, dry stock's understood to be beef, sheep and deer farming, which isn't quite the definition that we have here. Now, I'm only asking these questions because you've had such a lengthy experience with Plan Change 1, but the decision amended this definition of dry stock in three ways. It introduced other dairy animals into the definition, added goats to the list, and changed wool from fibre. There's nothing in the decision that explains why those changes have been made, so I wondered if you had any recollection, purely because you were involved back then. I'm not expecting you to, I'm just wondering if you can assist as to where this has come from.
No, I'm sorry, it's an ambitious question to be on the spot.
Okay, no, that's absolutely fine. I couldn't find it anywhere, and I thought you were probably my best chance at clarifying something for me. So in the decision version of the rules, the particular matters captured in this dry stock farming definition had one gateway to pass, and all other farming went through the second option.
It seems to be the way it reads, yes.
Okay. And so as I understand the version that your client is putting forward, all other farming is now split into dry stock, dairy, arable cropping, or a catch-all of all other farming. Is that your understanding of what's been put forward?
In terms of the gateways.
So there's now, instead of having an all other farming gateway,
yes,
in some rules there's a dairy gateway. In some rules, there's an arable cropping gateway. And then otherwise, all other farming is either the permitted rule 311.4.1 for small scale properties or fully discretionary under the default rule. Is that your understanding of what you've put forward?
There is a question I think in my mind. I'm just trying to follow this. Whether the fact that it doesn't mention all other farming means that it's not actually included within rule, for example, rule 3.
Well, it's not. It's not mentioned there anymore. You've changed all other farming to dairy.
No, but the rule still talks about the use of land for farming.
Mm-hmm. So which category would you go through?
Just
current post-conferencing version of the rule?
Yes, sir. And it's the same in the Fonterra version and the Federal Farmers version.
So the activity is broader than those two are captured by the definition of farming at the moment.
By farming, yes, that's right. Yes.
But there is no particular gateway for activities other than dry stock and dairy.
That's right. So if they're not on properties under 20 hectares and captured by 3.11.4.1, they default to 3.11.4.7.
Yes, that sounds right. Yes. I'm not sure they do it from one, do they? Because you're still captured by the definition of farming, and none of those conditions. Sorry, on the hoof, I'm just wondering whether. I'm just wondering how you get to the conclusion that a non-dairy, non-dry stock farm would default under Rule 1 to Rule 7.
Because Condition 10 of Rule 1 says that as soon as you're over 20 hectares, you can either only be horses or free-range poultry.
Oh, okay, but not east. Yes, okay. So it catches those activities, but not other activities.
That's right.
Yes, that's true.
So, can I check when you prepared the revised gateways, with the changes that you're proposing to the dry stock gateway, when you reassessed those stocking units, was that by reference to the PC1 definition of dry stock?
Yes, but I believe the dry stock, well, this is probably a question for the systems people, Dr. O'Neill or something like that, but I believe those stock unit thresholds were developed based on a dry stock farm with a threshold accepting a certain number of dairy grazing cattle, and when you tipped over a certain number of the stocking rate of dairy grazers, then you would flip to the you fall out of that threshold and you fall to a higher, dry stock farm.
Right. So in those stocking numbers, as you're now putting forward in the dry stock rule, that was for both beef and sheep farmers as well as dairy support cattle farms.
Yeah, so it'd be a dry stock farm who takes in some dairy, some sort of grazing over a winter period. That scenario that formed the threshold of where you would flip from being a low to a moderate dry stock farm.
Okay. And in replacing the all other farming gateway with your dairy gateway, you didn't specifically turn your mind to what it did to other farming that wasn't dairy or dry stock.
I certainly didn't turn my mind to whether there was a type of farming activity that wasn't there for capture. I didn't turn my mind to that.
Okay. And so, if we look back at the definitions, looking at dairy cattle and dairy support cattle, it's my understanding that dairy cows become dairy support cattle if they're moved off the property, off the home farm, for want of a better word.
They stop being dairy cattle once they move off the dairy platform, that's right.
That's right. And they become dry stock at that point.
Well, not really, but for the purpose of the plan, they do become treated as part of a dry stock farm. Yes.
Right. And so then looking at the definition of dry stock farming, the dairy support cattle become dry stock farming if they're grazing on pasture.
periods of fall, cattle become sort of dry stock.
Your dry stock farming, if you're grazing dairy support cattle on pasture.
Yes.
And so if you're farming them on something other than pasture, you're farming.
So long with the pasture if this comes up?
At the beginning of dry stock farming.
You're suggesting that the words pasture grazing apply then to
the
all
list
of the types of animal in that long list?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so what you're saying is if you took your dairy cattle off a dairy farm, put them on a dry stock farm and grazed them on something other than pasture,
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't fit the definition.
That's right, and so you'd be farming.
So that would be something else other than dry stock and dairy farm. Yes, that seems to be logical. It's not something I consider, but I follow that logic, yes.
Okay. And so then if they're grazing on something that fits into the definition of arable cropping, lucerne as a legume would be an example of an arable crop that you may graze stock on.
Yes, I understand it, yes.
And I think rapeseed would fall into the oilseed category and therefore be arable cropping.
You're probably getting to the edge of my farm, so
right.
Yes, it is, but that sounds
okay.
Reasonable.
And I'm not as familiar in the Waikato as I am in Southland in terms of what crops cattle can be grazed on, but examples such as kale, swede, fodder beef, brassicas, etc., they're not arable cropping, are they?
Kale, what is it? Swedes?
Fodder beets.
Brassicas. They don't appear to be.
Right. And so if we turn to the definition of farming then, grazing animals on those crops is farming.
I'll say so, yes.
Right. Okay. And so, in a fairly standard Waikato example of a dairy farm with a runoff block, that's now considered a single operating unit as per the definition, but your average farmer is going to need to assess under the dairy gateway, the dry stock gateway, the arable cropping gateway, and then the farm and catch-all.
All those divisions will be relevant to them, yes.
Right. Rather than just one farming gateway as per the decisions version.
Two gateways for the decision version, isn't it? Still dairy and dry stock.
Yes, although the dry stock would only have applied if you weren't other things as well.
Yes, okay, yes.
Do you
lots of versions to follow, I'm sorry.
Do you accept that this new approach that is being put forward has a high potential for confusion amongst the farming sector?
I don't know that the farming sector's tolerance for confusion, but I suspect that it could be.
Well, I got highly confused.
So if you confused me, I'd say that's probably.
And needing to split out your operation into multiple components and check which rules potentially apply under a number has the potential for inefficiencies?
Depending on how it's implemented and what advice and guidance the council puts around it.
Do you see the potential for a complicated suite of consents, or at least consent triggers, for your average farming operation?
I can certainly see it could be easier and more straightforward.
And with Ms. May earlier in the week telling us that the council was looking for a simple and pragmatic approach in the rules, do you accept it would be better to simply capture all other farming, like in the decisions version?
I need to think about the implications, but potentially that would be one solution to the issues that you've identified. There may be others as well.
So I'd like to then turn to the nitrogen risk scorecard. And not the scorecard itself, but the aggregate that is now being proposed. As Mr. Allen confirmed yesterday, the scorecard looks purely at the dairy farm affected area on a farm, and that this area reduces as land is retired, setbacks are increased, or a farmer moves into diversified land uses away from dairy, with no reduction in the aggregate score through the scorecard. Now, do you accept that all of those actions will be needed to meet the objectives of Plan Change 1? Retiring land, increasing setbacks, ultimately land change.
Certainly some of those things, not really property, wouldn't necessarily be able to retire land on this. Maybe it has some properties, but not all.
But you agree that those actions, which will be needed across the catchment but not necessarily on every property, are not reflected in the NRS aggregate?
No, it doesn't set out to do a kind of whole farm assessment of pros and, I guess, mitigations and things. It's just not set up to do that. It's very much focused on core farming inputs and practices, as I understand.
Right. And so we had Mr. Slattery yesterday, who has already fenced all of the water bodies on her farm, including the ephemeral water bodies. Those types of measures aren't picked up at all in the NRS aggregate score.
Not that I can recall. So you're saying picking up fencing beyond what she, I can't recall what the scorecard is, but it certainly doesn't pick up things for the ephemeral streams as a mitigation that offsets the score.
Given that it is only focused on the practices on the grazed or dairy farm effective area, do you accept that we have no confidence it's going to capture the worst or the highest risk farms in the catchment?
Do I have confidence? No confidence.
No confidence. It's simply going to find us 25% of farms.
Oh, I see what you're saying. It will find 25% of farms which have the highest risk scores. And to the extent that that doesn't necessarily predict the true and actual risk from a whole farm, or that all matters considered perspective, then that's true. It might necessarily pick up the 25% of the farms, the high category, which have the highest net risk to water. It will pick up the 25% of farms which have the highest input and practice risk as defined by the scorecard. Yes.
Right. And so Mr. Allen, in answers to questions from the court yesterday, or it might not have been from the court, it may have been Mr. Conway, that there was a very high risk that different farms would be captured by the NRS tool than by the NLLR tool. Do you agree with that?
I couldn't really put a description on it. It's highly likely there will be a different cohort captured by NRS as opposed to overseas. As I understand, both those tools are quite different tools operating.
Right. do you accept that farmers do not yet know their NRS aggregate scores and therefore which bin, to use Dr. Dupree's word, which bin they fit into?
I don't. As you said, they get the subset of six individual risk scores.
Sure.
But it's not aggregated in the annual reporting that they get from Ontario at this point.
Right. Are you aware that farmers that have specifically asked for their aggregate score have not been provided it?
No, I don't think that. They've got
So do you accept that farmers do not yet know their aggregate score and therefore which bin they fall into?
I don't know any more than I've really said to you. I don't know whether they have done their own aggregation of their scores or what. I don't know. All I know is that they've got information from the scorecard. It doesn't directly help them determine whether they are currently in or whether they will be in these particular bins.
I see. Okay. And that's compared to the decisions version with the use of NLR, that any farmer with an overseer file could work out which bin they fall into.
If you have an overseer file, yes. And in the case of even if the email wasn't there, I think Mr. Ellen's evidence yesterday was that 80% of farmers probably didn't have it.
Mr. Allen said that Fonterra doesn't hold the overseer files for its suppliers anymore, but that's a different question, isn't it, as to whether a farmer...
Oh, yes, it is a different question, because some of them won't evidence was that some of them will have the fertiliser companies holding the overseer file, but I don't know how that works in terms of every farmer who has an overseer file needs to pay annual subscription. And I think they'll probably know
sure.
if they have or not.
The short point being, though, that if a farmer has an overseer file, they can currently work out which bin in the decisions version they fall into.
If they have a current overseer file, they have an output number which they can use to see whether they're in each of those bins.
Right.
Whether that would generate 25% of the top bin, though, is another issue.
Sure. And that's because farmers may have been proactively making changes on farm to reduce their overseer number.
That's quite a possibility, or because the overseer version we use now isn't the same as it was used in 2016.
I see. Well, those are questions I can ask to a specialist later in the hearing. Right. Do you agree that it is better to know at the time the rules are set which category you fit into? As a user of a plan, it's better to understand at the time the rules are set.
As a user, yes. I mean, as long as from a plan-making perspective, as long as you know how many are going to fit in, that allows you to conduct a Section 32 analysis. So from a council planning bank preparation perspective, you don't need to know who, you just need to know how many. But from a farmer's point of view, that would be a different thing. They obviously need to know, they would need to know their school to know the better.
And do you think if we're looking at changing the tools in a way that capture potentially an entirely different cohort, that the affected farmers would want to know they're affected before that change takes place?
They might want to at this point in the process, it might not do them any good, but...
That's true. Okay, moving on then to the the way Schedule B works. Now, I won't necessarily call it your Schedule B, but the wording is identical in all three versions that the court currently has, so it doesn't matter which one you go to. But I'm particularly interested in this rolling average 5 years, 3 years issue. And particularly, as I understand it, the ranges in the rules, for example, the 111 to 123 in the permitted activity, that number is 5 seasons of average data.
That's correct, because I understand
how
those numbers are derived.
That's right.
Years under the way that
So if we look at Schedule B, which is how you calculate your nitrogen risk scorecard, and I'd like to start with three. For farms that require consent, the nitrogen risk scorecard is to be for the full farm year immediately prior to the date when the consent is required. So that's just 1 year. Now, given the evidence that I, well, the answers I heard you give this morning, is that what you would intend? That a farmer has 1 year?
This is for the purpose of getting through the gateway, isn't it? This is for the purpose of meeting the gateway test of the rule.
As you have put it forward, yes.
Yes. So. So 1 year is not going to give you necessarily a fair reflection of a multi-year experience on farm.
I wouldn't have thought so, no. But to calculate the gateway, doesn't three say you've only got 1 year?
It does.
And doesn't it lock it in as the year before consent's required? So not necessarily the year before you apply, but the year before your catchment date comes up on the table. Right. Do you support the wording of three?
I think that there is an argument that it could be a three-year-old average or something. Experience on farm. Just trying to think what that does to the, that it makes some difference to the rule, to how you'll get through that third, if you like. But in principle, I'm accepting the point that a 3-year rolling average might be a better, 8-year rolling average might be a better approach.
If we then turn to four, maybe just take a moment to read it in case you haven't recently. So if we assume that plan change one is made operative sometime after the 1st of June 2024, am I reading that correctly that it's your nitrogen risk scorecard for this current farming year that determines if you're permitted?
Yes.
And if you achieve that this farming year, you remain permitted for the life of Plan Change 1?
If you remain permitted?
Yes.
That's not the way I would see it, no.
Okay, so where does, why not?
Well, you still have to keep within the gateway thresholds, obviously. So if you go beyond the 111 or whatever.
Well, the gateway says in accordance with Schedule B, and Schedule B says it's this year. Is that not your intent?
Rule. I think it's not intent, no.
I see. That's right, so long as it's not your intent, but that's how the rule works, as you've put it forward.
So the intent is clearly, as I've articulated, you need to keep them in the 123.111 band to be, below the threshold band to stay within rule one. If you go above that band, if you go above that band, you clearly fit into a high school collab.
I see. And so that's how you thought these provisions worked.
That's how they need to work.
Okay. So bearing in mind that farmers don't know their aggregate score at the moment, but could potentially change their practices this year in order to take advantage of the permitted activity status, do you think it would be helpful if farmers were told their aggregate scores for last farming?
Yes.
Are you aware of any reason as to why that hasn't been provided, including to farmers that have asked for the aggregate score?
No, that would be a question for Frontier.
Okay. Now, as I'm reading the rule package, but it may not also have been your intent, to generate the nitrogen risk scorecard, the farmer can enter the data for those 6 points into the portal that the council will at some point create. Is that your understanding of how it's generated?
This is where it hasn't been entirely confirmed, I suppose. That has always been the expectation that Fonterra holds the mechanism to be able to do that. It would share that with the council, and the council would set up a portal, and farmers would then enter in the data.
Mm-hmm. And so the farmers enter in the data and generate their score?
Yes, maybe farmers. I'm not sure whether the implementation issues really, whether the milk companies, for example, would do it for farmers. It might be something they do, I don't know.
Right. Good question. But unlike the NLLR and the decisions version, it doesn't need to be done by a certified advisor.
That's correct.
Now, you may have already answered these questions in response to Mr. Conway this morning, but as I understand it, you now accept that it is worth at least retaining NLLR as an option in Schedule B at this point.
No, I didn't say that.
Ah.
Oh, sorry, in Schedule B?
Yes.
No. I think what I was saying was, in terms of ongoing reporting, remembering that I was supporting the position where you report your risk,
mm-hmm.
or intensity over time, and that there was the rule currently, it's always has, and it still does, provide flexibility as to which tool you use to report that. So all I'm saying is that if you did not want to report, for example, your stocking rate, as a measure of your particular time, you could use another mechanism, and that would potentially include overseer if you wanted to use overseer. So why I see that there.
Oh, I see. So maybe I misunderstood. I thought Mr. Conway took you to Schedule B as per the Federated Farmers version and asked you some questions around the AA brown text, but I might have been micro-mapping.
I don't recall taking to that provision, but I don't recall. Well, it certainly did not intend to suggest that I supported the use of overseer as a gateway test.
Right. So you maintain the position that the all other farming gateway should be removed, and that dairy should instead for the home farm at least, have the NYCHA risk scorecard gateway and only that gateway?
Yes, I mean, I have difficulty supporting the NLR as a gateway, and then because once that, mainly because of the reasonably extensive history I've had with overseas and what I've said about in the past. And so when you use, if you use that as a gateway, and therefore, particularly in the context of a high risk dairy farm, it absolutely is using it in an absolute way, because you're requiring a benchmark and then reduce to a particular absolute number. Then that is a use of overseer I would struggle to do. So that is the problem I have with this issue, like continuing to use the NLR.
Sorry, I don't understand that answer. So it's purely as a way of identifying the worst performing 25% of farms.
But it's not, because if you are under the worst 25% of farms, the obligation is to get down to the 75% of, which is a number. It would have to be under the table would be a number, a specified overseer leaching rate number. So you would be given, you might enter that system as a someone leaching 70 kilograms per hectare per year. Your obligation would be to get down to 50, let's say, kilograms per hectare per year.
And so that obligation, are you meaning in terms of improving your activity status?
No,
or the driver for policies?
Once you've got the consent, the rule framework requires you to reduce, if you're high, reduce to moderate. Moderate is articulated and expressed as a leaching rate number.
Right, and so that's your problem with the use of that as the gateway. That is helpful. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for your answers, Mr. Willis. I've got no further questions, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I'm not sure how long you might be. You might go over for lunch break or something. And in terms of the way we're tracking, what I'm going to propose to do is break the evidence of Mr. Willis. We'll deal with Mr. Geisman straight after lunch if he is available. Ms. Edwards, yes, thank you. And then we'll return to Mr. Willis.
Yes, thank you, sir.
Is that all right?
Absolutely fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Mitchell, my only constraint is 5:35 flight, so I need to leave a little earlier than 4:30.
Yeah, we'll be wrapping up then as well. I think it's likely at the rate we're going that Mr. Willis will be back here the week after next. No. As many of us may well be. Don't be done, huh?
Rather than break the flow, Mr. Willis, I'll just ask you one more question from where you finished off with Ms. Carruthers. If the rule framework were changed so that the OCL, NLR, would not be used as an absolute number in the context of telling the high leechers what they have to do, you would have more comfort using it, or comfort using it as the gateway tool.
There is a bunch of issues in that. So, it would certainly be less problematic to me to do that. It's only a way of drafting people into a certain category. It's not absolute in the sense that it doesn't relate to a express limit or a reduction target expressed in overseer leaching rate terms, then that is a less egregious form of using overseer equipment, if you like to put it that way. It's more simple way of using overseer equipment.
Okay. Thank you. Now I'd like to take you to the joint witness statement for Fanon. Thank you. we can go to question 6. Which relates to objective 5. Here, Ms. Maas suggesting that the objective refer to hydrological drivers in relation to the objective that relates to the whangarino wetland. And do you have a problem with including those words in objective 5, which state including the hydrological drivers of the transport and deposition of those contaminants?
This is not an issue that I have given thought to, it wasn't within the scope of my client's appeal, and I wasn't briefed to consider it, so I'm reluctant to offer a view on the purpose of what it was.
Alright, no, that's fine. It's just that I thought you were present for that and disagreed with it, but that's fine.
I actually probably wasn't even present for that discussion because I was. No, I certainly didn't disagree with it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was present for that, actually, but I wasn't there for the 4 or 3 days.
Alright, I saw that. Thank you. So then if we can go to question 7, which is policy 1. And if we look under the matters of disagreement, Ms. Kizik and Ms. Ma are seeking what I would summarise as more direction as to the timeframes in which actions to be undertaken, both in the chapeau, where they are seeking in a reference back to the interim target attribute states being achieved within 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ms. Ma is also seeking the timely implementation of farm environment plans within 8 years of the chapter 311 becoming operative. Do you agree that the term appropriate specified time period is currently quite loose?
So can you just take me exactly where I just lost your
which bit?
Which part of the policy you're referring to?
You may need to look at page 8. So firstly, it's in the chapeau they're seeking that it include reference in A, requiring a general improvement in farm practice, including through the timely implementation, and they're seeking that it cross-refer to within, seeking the attribute states be achieved within 10 years effectively. So that's the first thing. Then you may need to refer to the actual provisions because I don't see the term appropriate specified time period as stated for the JWS. But you would have seen that in the provisions. Sorry, I've got confused myself. That's in policy 2, actually. But if I can just ask your question at a bit of a higher level. Do you consider that there could be more tightening up of guidance as to when certain actions should be achieved? And I know that there are specifics in relation to the Schedule C stock exclusion requirements.
It's hard to answer that in sort of abstract, but I do think farm environment plans should have time bound actions, so the extent to which risks are identified in actions are identified to reduce those risks, that they should be time bound. So I do see these farm environment plans working time. I'm not sure that you're referring to that.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, farm environment plans.
Yep.
And so in the regulations and farm environment plans, they have to set a time frame with it in which action should be implemented. And Regulation 8.3 says when identifying actions and setting timeframes, the farm operator must consider the significance of the risk to freshwater and freshwater ecosystems and whether a timeframe for a particular action is required under a specific instrument. I'm simply asking you, do you consider that there should be a requirement in PC1 that all or some actions under a farm environment plan should be completed within a specific time frame?
I probably don't, because I think that's part of why you do a farm environment plan, because with every farm, things will be more or less practicable to do within a certain time frame. And that's what I understand is one of the purposes of a farm environment plan is that you can tailor your actions and your time frames to suit the situation. Whilst regulations provide for sequence, and we have got that for substitution, certain uniform time frames, I think for many other things, we'll use bespoke to the farm.
So you wouldn't consider that it would be appropriate to put a cut-off period, say 20 years, 30 years, or something like that?
Was that come up for review every 5 years? I've always assumed there would be short-term things to be done within that 5 years and things to be done on a longer time frame. And potentially, given this plan and the time frames in it, things could be done many years ahead if they're very expensive items. So, but again, I don't know that we can specify that any more than we have.
Alright, thank you. Policy 7 that relates to the time period of consents being granted. Now, I see you weren't present for that area of discussion. Is that right?
Yes,
that's right. So, is your view a 10-year maximum time frame, and what's your view on the word generally in that policy?
what's the view on a 10-year time frame?
You can start with the time frame, and then I'll ask you about the word generally at the start of the policy.
As opposed to 15 years, that's your point?
Yes.
Duration is one of these things. It's very hard to clear marker on the ground. And then I was quite attracted to the Federated Farmers' position of actually now in 15 years, but still at a cut-off date, which essentially meant that the ones later on, the last catchment, would only be 10-year consent. So that's a bit of, I thought that was a reasonable solution to take.
15 years with a cut-off date of, say, 2014?
I think that was the position that was in Federated Farms' proposal, I believe.
Well, I think they were 10 years, actually. No? Oh, sorry. No, they were a cut-off date of 2014.
So I think that means, for me, that the early ones were 15 years and the last ones, the last catch was 2018.
Okay. Because what feeds into this, doesn't it, and it's summarised well in this NAS evidence,
Sorry, I'm switching to box. Which is
319, Your Honour.
Thank you very much.
So the page I'd be wanting to take you to is, if you found her evidence, is 3190255.
Sorry,
can you give the number? 319.0255.
Yes.
So this is in paragraph 109 of her evidence. Do you have that there?
I do, yes.
She goes through her understanding from the evidence, and Dr. Cannon's no longer giving it evidence, but regarding the target attribute states in PC1 and how they need to be changed in the 2024 plan change. So that's paraphrasing, of course, but she says, for nutrients, they're not set at a level that provides for ecosystem health with abundant life. And that's A. So do not give effect to the direction in the NPS report M or Te Tiri Whaimana. Now if we go down to C, the ammonia target attribute states are set below national bottom lines in some catchments. D, the long-term target attribute states are set at national bottom lines despite some lakes having better state, and there are no interim 10-year target attribute states for lakes. Then E, the target attribute states for rivers feeding into lakes in the Whangamurino are not set at a level that would achieve states for the lakes in the wetland. F, there are no target attribute states for periphyton or dissolved oxygen. And G, they don't take into account modelling information available. So, given that and the work that's going to, first of all, do you agree that that's the position, or have you turned your mind to that?
Well, I haven't turned my mind to it. Indeed, the whole range of its evidence, and I think this is the statement director on those matters. But I don't think that's the prize that we never intended to do all those things, of course. But, so I agree that the target attribute states will need to be revised and changed as a result of the extension.
So given that and the work that Mr. McAuliffe said is going into the 2024 plan change and the changing regulatory environment we have, which includes, of course, legislation perhaps in amending the first-in-first-served allocation of water and providing for different tools and mechanisms for considering, say, a group of applications at a sub-catchment level, don't you consider we should err with a shorter time frame, so 10 years maximum rather than a longer time frame?
Well, as I said, I think the proposal that the farmers put forward is a pretty good compromise. I mean, we're talking 5 years, but we are talking about giving the farmers a bit of certainty about what they're doing over the next period of 2040. So I don't see that evidence as necessarily changing my position. That 15, generally 15, but getting closer to 10 as we get further in, is probably the best approach. I think shorter time frames do become quite problematic.
I'll just ask one more question for the lunch break, sir.
Yes, thank you.
So the word generally at the beginning of that policy, there's no guidance on how that would be applied. Do you consider that that is going to provide potential issues with farmers making strong submissions and lobbying council for longer time frames on a case-by-case basis, which may ultimately threaten the ability to achieve long-term target attribute states?
In my experience, applicants will always argue for long time frames. That's the way it goes. And major issue in, I don't see a major issue in the general government. I think I know what you're saying, that if the door was therefore open for a longer time frame, people would seek to use that. But I think it's a question of council implementation and how they apply that, and if they apply that consistently. I think the intent is pretty clear that there would have to be some sort of exceptional basis to allow you to seek and be granted a longer time frame. And that's probably not unreasonable, I think. If there's a particular reason why a farmer, a particular type of farmer, a particular action it's got to do, the investment it's got to make, can justify something longer, then that's probably reasonable, in my view. But I think it's pretty clear the exception, it would be by exception only.
Right, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Omni.
I have a few more questions.
I understand that. So, Mr. Willis, we'll interrupt your evidence at this stage. If you might just pick up your own papers and leave a little bit of space for Mr. Guyton, who will come up at 2:15 at lunch, and then hopefully you'll be able to return not too long after that, depending on how many questions there are. Anything else that anybody wants to raise before we go to lunch and in terms of how we're going to conduct this afternoon? I think everyone's reasonably clear, and just to confirm, we will be adjourning no later than 4:30 to enable people who have connections to make the travel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just in a second.